Chapter 5, Second World War, The Locust Years, 1931 to 1935.
The British government, which resulted from the general election of 1931, was in appearance one of the strongest, and in fact one of the weakest, in British records. Mr. Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister, had severed himself with the utmost bitterness on both sides from the Socialist Party, which it had been his life's work to create. Henceforward, he brooded supinely at the head of an administration which, though nominally national, was in fact overwhelmingly conservative. Mr. Baldwin preferred the substance to the form of power and reigned placidly in the background. During the period of almost 5 years of this administration, from January 1931 to November 1935, the entire situation on the continent of Europe was reversed. All Germany was astir, and great events marched forward.
The 24th of April, 1933. The Royal Society of St. George Dinner, London. The speaker, Winston Churchill, gives his contemporary version of the legend of St. George and the Dragon.
And I am going to speak to you about St. George and the Dragon. I have been wondering what would have happened to him and to his story if he'd lived nowadays. If his achievements had to be repeated in a modern sense. Well, I suppose it would have been something like this. St. George would have arrived in Cappadocia, accompanied not by a war horse, but by a highly competent secretary. He would be armed not with a lance, but with some flexible formula. He would, of course, be welcomed enthusiastically by the local branch of the League of Nations Union. Fortified by their encouragement, he would just propose a conference with the dragon. It would be a round table conference, no doubt. That's so much more convenient for the dragon's tail. He would then proceed to make a trade agreement with the dragon. He would certainly lend the dragon a lot of money. Raised from the highly dried Cappadocian textile. Well, so much for St. George and the Dragon.
We return to Chapter 5, The Second World War, The Locust Years.
On the 21st of March, 1933, Hitler opened in the garrison church at Potsdam the first Reichstag of the Third Reich. In the body of the church sat the representatives of the Reichswehr, the symbol of the continuity of German might. On March 24, the majority of the Reichstag, overbearing and overawing all opponents, confirmed by 441 votes to 94 complete emergency powers to Chancellor Hitler for 4 years. As the result was announced, Hitler turned to the benches of the socialists and cried, "And now I have no further need of you." It is not within my scope to describe the inconceivable brutality and villainy by which this apparatus of hatred and tyranny had been fashioned, and was now to be perfected. It is necessary for the purposes of this account only to present the new and fearful fact which had broken upon the still unwitting world, Germany under Hitler, and Germany arming. While these deadly changes were taking place in Germany, the MacDonald-Baldwin government felt bound to enforce for some time the severe reductions and restrictions which the financial crisis had imposed upon our already modest armaments, and steadfastly closed their eyes and ears to the disquieting symptoms in Europe. In vehement efforts to procure a disarmament of the victors equal to that which had been enforced upon the vanquished by the Treaty of Versailles, Mr. Macdonald and his Conservative and Liberal colleagues pressed a series of proposals forward in the League of Nations and through every other channel that was open. When in May 1932 the virtues of disarmament were extolled in the House of Commons by all parties, the Foreign Secretary opened a new line in the classification of weapons which should be allowed or discouraged. He called this qualitative disarmament. It was easier to expose the fallacy than to convince the members. I said, Foreign Secretary told us that it was difficult to divide weapons into offensive and defensive categories. It certainly is, because almost every conceivable weapon may be used in defense or offense, either by an aggressor or by the innocent victim of his assault. To make it more difficult for the invader, heavy guns, tanks, and poison gas are to be relegated to the evil category of offensive weapons. The invasion of France by Germany in 1914 reached its climax without the employment of any of these weapons. The heavy gun is to be described as an offensive weapon. It is all right in a fortress. There it is virtuous and pacific in its character. But bring it out into the field, and of course if it were needed, it would be brought out into the field, and it immediately becomes naughty, peccant, militaristic, and has to be placed under the ban of civilization. Take the tank. The tank was invented to overcome the fire of the machine guns with which the Germans were maintaining themselves in France, and it saved a lot of lives in clearing the soil of the invader. Now apparently the machine gun, which was a German weapon for holding on to 13 provinces of France, is to be the virtuous defensive machine gun, and the tank, which was the means by which the Allied lives were saved, is to be placed under the censure and obloquy of all just and righteous men. A truer classification might be drawn in banning weapons which tend to be indiscriminate in their action and whose use entails death and wounds, not merely on the combatant in the fighting zones, but on the civil population, men, women, and children, far removed from those areas. There, indeed, it seemed to me, would be a direction in which the United Nations assembled at Geneva might advance with hope. At the end of this speech, I gave my first formal warning of approaching war. I should very much regret to see any approximation in military strength between Germany and France. Those who speak of that as though it were right, or even a question of fair dealing, altogether underrate the gravity of the European situation. I would say to those who would like to see Germany and France on an equal footing in armaments, do you wish for war? For my part, I earnestly hope that no such approximation will take place during my lifetime or that of my children. To say that is not in the least to imply any want of regard or admiration for the great qualities of the German people. But I am sure that the thesis that they should be placed in an equal military position with France is one which, if ever it emerged in fact, would bring us within practical distance of an almost measureless calamity. The British air estimates of March 1933 revealed a total lack of comprehension alike by the government and the opposition of what was going on. I had to say on March 14, regretted to hear the Undersecretary say that we were only the fifth air power and that the 10-year program was suspended for another year. I was sorry to hear him boast that the Air Ministry had not laid down a single new unit this year. All these ideas are being increasingly stultified by the march of events, and we should be well advised to concentrate upon our air defences with greater vigour. Under the so-called national government, British public opinion showed an increasing inclination to cast aside all care about Germany. In vain the French had pointed out correctly in a memorandum of July 21, 1931, that the general assurance given at Versailles that a universal limitation of armaments should follow the one-sided disarmament of Germany did not constitute a treaty obligation. It certainly was not an obligation enforceable apart from time and circumstance. Yet when in 1932 the German delegation to the disarmament conference categorically demanded the removal of all restrictions upon their right to rearm, they found much support in the British press. The Times spoke of the timely redress of inequality, and the New Statesman of the unqualified recognition of the principle of the equality of states. This meant that the 70 million Germans ought to be allowed to rearm and prepare for war without the victors in the late fearful struggle being entitled to make any objection. The German government were emboldened by the British demeanor. In July, their delegation gathered up its papers and quitted the disarmament conference. To coax them back then became the prime political object of the victorious Allies. In November, the French, under severe and constant British pressure, proposed what was somewhat unfairly called the Herriot Plan. The essence of this was the reconstruction of all European defense forces as short service armies with limited numbers, admitting equality of status, but not necessarily accepting equality of strength. In fact and in principle, the admission of equality of status made it impossible, ultimately, not to accept equality of strength. This enabled the Allied government to offer to Germany equality of rights in a system which would provide security for all nations. Under certain safeguards of an illusory character, the French were reduced to accepting this meaningless formula. On this, the Germans consented to return to the disarmament conference. This was hailed as a notable victory for peace. Fanned by the breeze of popularity, His Majesty's government now produced, on March 16, 1933, what was called, after its author and inspirer, the MacDonald Plan. It accepted as its starting point the adoption of the French conception of short service armies, in this case of 8 months' service, and proceeded to prescribe exact figures for the troops of each country. By this time, the German military forces, although not yet provided with the mass of trained reserves, which only a succession of annual conscripted quotas could supply, may well have amounted to the equivalent of over 1 million armed volunteers, partially equipped, and with many forms of the latest weapons coming along through the convertible and partially converted factories to arm them. At the end of the First World War, France, like Great Britain, had an enormous mass of heavy artillery, whereas the cannon of the German army had in fact been blown to bits, according to treaty. Mr. MacDonald sought to remedy this evident inequality by proposing to limit the caliber of mobile artillery guns to 105 millimeters, or 4.2 inches. Existing guns up to 6 inches could be retained, but all replacements were to be limited to 4.2 inches. British interests, as distinct from those of France, were to be protected by the maintenance of the treaty restrictions against German naval armaments till 1935, when it was proposed that a new naval conference should meet. Military aircraft were prohibited to Germany for the duration of the agreement, but the three Allied powers should reduce their own air forces to 500 planes apiece. I viewed this attack upon the French armed forces and the attempt to establish equality between Germany and France with strong aversion, and on the 23rd of March, 1933, I had the opportunity of saying to Parliament, "I doubt the wisdom of pressing this plan upon France at the present time. I do not think the French will agree. They must be greatly concerned at what is taking place in Germany, as well as at the attitude of some others of their neighbors. I dare say that during this anxious month, there are a good many people who have said to themselves, as I have been saying for several years, thank God for the French army. When we read about Germany, when we watch with surprise and distress the tumultuous insurgence of ferocity and war spirit, the pitiless ill treatment of minorities, the denial of the normal protections of civilized society, the persecution of large numbers of individuals solely on the ground of race, when we see all that occurring in one of the most gifted, learned, and scientific and formidable nations in the world, one cannot help feeling glad that the fierce passions that are raging in Germany have not yet found any other outlet but upon themselves. It seems to me that at a moment like this, to ask France to halve her army while Germany doubles hers, to ask France to halve her air force while the German air force remains whatever it is, it's a proposal likely to be considered by the French government, at present at any rate, as somewhat unreasonable. I spoke again in April. The Germans demand equality in weapons and equality in the organization of fleets and armies. And we have been told we cannot keep so great a nation in an inferior position. What others have, they must have. I have never agreed. It is a most dangerous demand to make. Nothing in life is eternal, but as surely as Germany acquires full military equality with her neighbors, while her own grievances are still unredressed, and while she is in the temper which we have unhappily seen, so surely should we see ourselves within a measurable distance of the renewal of general European war. One of the things which we were told after the Great War would be a security for us, but that Germany would be a democracy with parliamentary institutions. All that has been swept away. You have most grim dictatorship. You have militarism and appeals to every form of fighting spirit. From the reintroduction of drilling in the colleges to the Minister of Education advising the plentiful use of the cane in the elementary schools. You have these martial or pugnacious manifestations, and also this persecution of the Jews, of which so many members have spoken. I will leave Germany and turn to France. France is not only the sole great surviving democracy in Europe, she is also the strongest military power, I am glad to say, and she is the head of a system of states and nations. France is the guarantor and protector of the whole crescent of small states which runs right round from Belgium to Yugoslavia and Romania. They all look to France. When any step is taken by England or any other power to weaken the diplomatic or military security of France, all these small nations tremble with fear and anger. They fear that the central protective force will be weakened, and that then they will be at the mercy of the great Teutonic power. When one considers that the facts are hardly in dispute, the actions of a responsible government of respectable men and the public opinion which so flocculently supported them are scarcely comprehensible. It was like being smothered by a feather bed. I remember particularly the look of pain and aversion which I saw on the faces of members in all parts of the House when I said, "Thank God for the French army." Words were vain. However, the French had the hardihood to insist that there should be a delay of 4 years before the destruction of their heavy war material. The British government accepted this modification, provided that the French agreement about the destruction of their artillery was specified in a document for immediate signature. France bowed to this, and on October the 12th, 1933, Sir John Simon, after complaining that Germany had shifted her ground in the course of the preceding weeks, brought these draft proposals before the disarmament conference. The result was unexpected. Hitler, now Chancellor and master of all Germany, having already given orders on assuming power to drive ahead boldly on a nationwide scale, both in the training camps and the factories, felt himself in a strong position. He did not even trouble to accept the quixotic offers pressed upon him. With a gesture of disdain, he directed the German government to withdraw both from the conference and from the League of Nations. Such was the fate of the MacDonald Plan. It is difficult to find a parallel to the unwisdom of the British and weakness of the French governments. Nor can the United States escape the censure of history absorbed in their own affairs, and all the abounding interests, they simply gaped at the vast changes which were taking place in Europe, and imagined that they were no concern of theirs. The considerable corps of highly competent, widely trained professional American officers formed their own opinions, but these produced no notable effect upon the improvident aloofness of American foreign policy. If the influence of the United States had been exerted, it might have galvanized French and British politicians into action. The League of Nations, battered though it had been, was still an august instrument which would have invested any challenge to the new Hitler war menace with the sanctions of international law. Under the strain, the Americans merely shrugged their shoulders, so that in a few years they had to pour out the blood and treasures of the New World to save themselves from mortal danger. In this dark time, the basest sentiments received acceptance or passed unchallenged by the responsible leaders of the political parties. In 1933, the students of the Oxford Union, under the inspiration of a Mr. Joad, passed their ever shameful resolution that this House refused to fight for king and country. It was easy to laugh off such an episode in England, but in Germany, in Russia, in Italy, in Japan, the idea of a decadent, degenerate Britain took deep root and swayed many calculations. Little did the foolish boys who passed the resolution dream that they were destined quite soon to conquer or fall gloriously in the ensuing war and prove themselves the finest generation ever bred in Britain. Less excuse can be found for their elders, who had no chance of self-redemption in action. In November 1933, we had another debate in the House of Commons. I return to my main theme. We read of large importations of scrap iron and nickel and war metals into Germany, quite out of the ordinary. We read all the news which accumulates of the military spirit which is rife throughout the country. We see that a philosophy of bloodlust is being inculcated into their youth, to which no parallel can be found since the days of barbarism. We see all these forces on the move, and we must remember that it is the same mighty Germany which fought all the world and almost beat the world. It is the same mighty Germany which took 2.5 lives for every German life that was taken. This, of course, excluded the Russian losses. No wonder when you have these preparations, these doctrines, and these assertions openly made that there is alarm throughout the whole circle of nations which surround Germany.
Chapter 7, 1934 to 1935. Air parity lost.
The German General Staff did not believe that the German army could be formed and matured on a scale greater than that of France and suitably provided with arsenals and equipment before 1943. But owing to the unlucky discovery by an immature civilization of the internal combustion engine and the art of flying, a new weapon of national rivalry had leapt upon the scene, capable of altering much more rapidly the relative war power of states. As in the case of the German army, the recreation of the German air power was long and carefully prepared in secret. In November came the Reichstag election, at which no candidates except those endorsed by Hitler were tolerated, and the Nazis obtained 95% of the votes polled. It would be wrong in judging the policy of the British government not to remember the passionate desire for peace which animated the uninformed, misinformed majority of the British people and seemed to threaten with political extinction any party or politician who dared to take any other line. This, of course, is no excuse for political leaders who fall short of their duty. It is much better for parties or politicians to be turned out of office than to imperil the life of the nation. Moreover, there is no record in our history of any government asking Parliament and the people for the necessary measures of defence and being refused. The air estimates of March 1934 totaled only 20 millions and contained provision for 4 new squadrons, or an increase in our first-line air strength from 850 to 890. On this I said, Germany is arming fast and no one is going to stop her. That seems quite clear. No one proposes a preventive war to stop Germany breaking the Treaty of Versailles. She is going to arm. She is doing it. She has been doing it. I have no knowledge of the details, but it is well known that those very gifted people, with their science and with their factories, with what they call their air sport, are capable of developing with great rapidity the most powerful air force for all purposes, offensive and defensive, within a very short period of time. I dread the day when the means of threatening the heart of the British Empire should pass into the hands of the present rulers of Germany. We should be in a position which would be odious to every man who values freedom of action and independence, and also in a position of the utmost peril for our crowded, peaceful population engaged in their daily toil. I dread that day, but it is not perhaps far distant. It is perhaps only a year, or perhaps 18 months distant. It has not come yet, at least so I believe, or I hope and pray. But it is not far distant. There is time for us to take the necessary measures, but it is the measures we want. We want the measures to achieve parity. No nation playing the part we play and aspire to play in the world has a right to be in the position where it can be blackmailed. None of the grievances between the victors and the vanquished have been redressed. The spirit of aggressive nationalism was never more rife in Europe and in the world. Far away are the days of Locarno, when we nourished bright hopes of the reunion of the European family. I call upon Mr. Baldwin as the man who possessed the power for action. His was the power and his the responsibility. In the course of his reply, Mr. Baldwin said, "If all our efforts for an agreement fail, and if it is not possible to obtain this equality in such matters as I have indicated, then any government of this country, a national government more than any, and this government, will see to it that in air strength and air power, this country shall no longer be in a position inferior to any country within striking distance of its shores." Here was a most solemn and definite pledge given at a time when it could almost certainly have been made good by vigorous action on a large scale. Although Germany had not yet openly violated the clauses of the treaty, which forbade her a military air force, civil aviation and an immense development of gliding had now reached a point where they could very rapidly reinforce and extend the secret and illegal military air force already formed. The blatant denunciations of communism and Bolshevism by Hitler had not prevented the clandestine sending by Germany of arms to Russia. On the other hand, from 1927 onwards, a number of German pilots were trained by the Soviets for military purposes. There were fluctuations, but in 1932, the British ambassador in Berlin reported that the Reichswehr had close technical liaison with the Red Army. No less when on the 20th of July, 1934, the government brought forward some belated and inadequate proposals for strengthening the Royal Air Force by 41 squadrons, or about 820 machines, only to be completed in 5 years. The Labour Party, supported by the Liberals, moved a vote of censure upon them in the House of Commons. Mr. Attlee, speaking in their name, said, "We deny the need for increased air armaments. We deny the proposition that an increased British Air Force will make for the peace of the world, and we reject altogether the claim to parity." I now enjoyed, for once, the advantage of being able to urge rearmament in the guise of a defender of the government. I therefore received an unusually friendly hearing from the Conservative Party. I do not suppose there has ever been such a pacifist-minded government. There is the Prime Minister, who in the war proved in the most extreme manner and with very great courage his convictions and the sacrifices he would make for what he believed was the cause of pacifism. The Lord President of the Council is chiefly associated in the public mind with the repetition of the prayer, "Give peace in our time." One would have supposed that when ministers like these come forward and say that they feel it their duty to ask for some small increase in the means they have of guaranteeing the public safety, it would weigh with the opposition and would be considered as a proof of the reality of the danger from which they seek to protect us. Then look at the apologies which the government have made. No one could have put forward a proposal in more extremely inoffensive terms. Meekness has characterized every word which they have spoken since this subject was first mooted. We are told that we can see for ourselves how small is the proposal. We are assured that it can be stopped at any minute if Geneva succeeds. And we are also assured that the steps we are taking, although they may to some lower minds have associated with them some idea of national defense, are really only associated with the great principle of collective security. We are a rich and easy prey. No country is so vulnerable, and no country would better repay pillage than our own. With our enormous metropolis here, the greatest target in the world, the kind of tremendous, fat, valuable cow tied up to attract the beast of prey, we are in a position in which we have never been before, and in which no other country is at the present time. By the end of 1935, the German Air Force will be nearly equal in numbers and efficiency to our home defense air force at that date, even if the government's present proposals are carried out. The third statement is that if Germany continues this expansion, and if we continue to carry out our scheme, then, sometime in 1936, Germany will be definitely and substantially stronger in the air than Great Britain. Fourthly, and this is the point which is causing anxiety, once they have got that lead, we may never be able to overtake them. If these assertions cannot be contradicted, then there is cause for the anxiety which exists in all parts of the House, not only because of the physical strength of the German Air Force, but I am bound to say also because of the character of the present German dictatorship. If the government have to admit at any time in the next 2 years that the German air forces are stronger than our own, then they will be held, and I think rightly held, to have failed in their prime duty to the country. The Labour Party's vote of censure was of course defeated by a large majority. It would have been possible in 1933 or even in 1934 for Britain to have created an air power which would have imposed the necessary restraints upon Hitler's ambition. More than 5 whole years had yet to run before we were to be confronted with the supreme ordeal. When the winter session opened on November the 28th, 1934, I moved in the name of some of my friends an amendment to the address. Germany already, at this moment, has a military air force. That is to say, military squadrons with the necessary ground services and the necessary reserves of trained personnel and material, which only awaits an order to assemble in full open combination, and that this illegal air force is rapidly approaching equality with our own. Secondly, by this time next year, if Germany executes her existing program without acceleration, and if we execute our existing program on the basis which now lies before us without slowing down, and carry out the increases announced to Parliament in July last, the German military air force will this time next year be in fact at least as strong as our own, and it may be even stronger. Thirdly, on the same basis, that is to say, both sides continuing with their existing programs as at present arranged, by the end of 1936, that is 1 year farther on, and 2 years from now, the German military air force will be nearly 50% stronger, and in 1937 nearly doubled. Mr. Baldwin, who followed me at once, faced this issue squarely, and on the case made out by his Air Ministry advisers, met me with direct contradiction. It is not the case that Germany is rapidly approaching equality with us. I cannot look farther forward than the next 2 years. Mr. Churchill speaks of what may happen in 1937. Such investigations as I have been able to make lead me to believe that his figures are considerably exaggerated. Thus, Mr. Baldwin. This sweeping assurance from the virtual Prime Minister soothed most of the alarmed and silenced many of the critics. Everyone was glad to learn that my precise statements had been denied of an unimpeachable authority. I was not at all convinced. I believe that Mr. Baldwin was not being told the truth by his advisers, and anyhow, that he did not know the facts. However, at the end of March, the Foreign Secretary, Mr. Eden, paid a visit to Herr Hitler in Germany. And in the course of an important conversation, the text of which is on record, they were told personally by him that the German Air Force had already reached parity with Great Britain. This fact was made public by the government on April the 3rd. At the beginning of May, the Prime Minister wrote an article in his own organ, the News Letter, which he emphasized the dangers of German rearmament in terms akin to those I had so often expressed since 1932. He used the revealing word ambush, which must have sprung from the anxiety of his heart. We had indeed fallen into an ambush. When in due course I was called in the debate, I said, the government have proposed these increases. They must face the storm. They will have to encounter every form of unfair attack. Their motives will be misrepresented. They will be calumniated and called warmongers. Every kind of attack will be made upon them by many powerful, numerous, and extremely vocal forces in this country. They are going to get it anyway. Why then not fight for something that will give us safety? Why then not insist that the provision for the Air Force should be adequate? Why then, however severe may be the censure, and ever strident the abuse which they have to face, at any rate, there will be this satisfactory result that His Majesty's government will be able to feel that in this, of all matters, the prime responsibility of a government, they have done their duty. Although the House listened to me with close attention, I felt a sensation of despair. To be so entirely convinced and vindicated in a matter of life and death to one's country, and not to be able to make Parliament and the nation heed the warning or bow to the proof by taking action, was an experience most painful. I went on. I confess that words fail me. In the year 1708, Mr. Secretary St. John, by a calculated ministerial indiscretion, revealed to the House the fact that the Battle of Almanza had been lost in the previous summer, because only 8,000 English troops were actually in Spain out of the 29,000 that had been voted by the House of Commons for this service. When a month later this revelation was confirmed by the government, it is recorded that the House sat in silence for half an hour. And yet how incomparably small that event was to what we have now to face. There lay in my memory at this time some lines from an unknown writer about a railway accident. I had learned them from a volume of Punch cartoons, which I used to pore over when I was 8 or 9 years old at school at Brighton. Who is in charge of the clattering train? The axles creak and the couplings strain, and the pace is hot and the points are near, and sleep hath deadened the driver here, and the signals flash through the night in vain, for death is in charge of the clattering train. It was not until May the 22nd that Mr. Baldwin made his celebrated confession. I'm forced to cite it. Here's what he said. First of all, with regard to the figure I gave in November of German aeroplanes, nothing has come to my knowledge since that makes me think that figure was wrong. I believed at that time it was right. Where I was wrong was in my estimate of the future. There I was completely wrong. We were completely misled on that subject. I think it is only due to say that there has been a great deal of criticism, both in the press and verbally, about the Air Ministry, as though they were responsible for possibly an inadequate program. I only want to repeat that whatever responsibility there may be, that responsibility is not that of any single minister. It is the responsibility of the government as a whole, and we are all responsible, and we are all to blame. I hope that this shocking confession will be a decisive event, and that at least a parliamentary committee of all parties will be set up to report upon the facts and upon our safety. The House of Commons had a different reaction. The Labour and Liberal oppositions, having 9 months earlier moved or supported a vote of censure, even upon the most modest steps the government had taken, were ineffectual and undecided. They were looking forward to an election against Tory armament. Neither the Labour nor the Liberal spokesmen had prepared themselves for Mr. Baldwin's disclosure and admission, and they did not attempt to adapt their speeches to this outstanding episode. The government majority, for their part, appeared captivated by Mr. Baldwin's candour. his admission of having been utterly wrong with all his sources of knowledge upon a vital matter for which he was responsible, was held to be redeemed by the frankness with which he had declared his error and shouldered the blame. There was even a strange wave of enthusiasm for a minister who did not hesitate to say he was wrong. Indeed, many Conservative members seemed angry with me for having brought their trusted leader to a plight from which only his native manliness and honesty had extricated him, but not alas in his country. A disaster of the first magnitude had fallen upon us. Hitler had already obtained parity with Great Britain. Henceforward, he had merely to drive his factories and training schools at full speed, not only to keep his lead in the air, but steadily to improve it. Very considerable efforts were made by the British government in the next 4 years, and there was no doubt that we excelled in air quality, but quantity was henceforth beyond us. The outbreak of the war found us with barely half the German numbers.